Don't worry, I'm not going to sing along, but the next line is, yeah, before you abuse, criticize, and accuse, walk a mile in my shoes. As a customer of products and service, have you ever wondered why the business does something the way they do? You ever feel like they're not treating me very nicely? And then, of course, sometimes we still go ahead and buy from them. Well, as it turns out, there is a direct link between empathy and commercial success. There is even an empathy index that I just learned about, which reveals the linkage between profitability and high levels of customer and employee empathy. Since this is a topic that fascinates me, I've asked Dr. Natalie Petahoff, the co-author of Empathy in Action, to join the show to talk about this very topic. I'm Mark Gandy, and this is CFO Bookshelf. Dr. Natalie Petahoff is our guest. She's a co-author of Empathy in Action. I want to read two quotes before we get started. The first one is from Atticus in To Kill a Mockingbird. You never really understand a person until you consider things from their point of view, until you climb into their skin and walk around in it. Do you agree with Atticus? Here's another one, and it is the opposite of what Atticus is saying. By the way, he's talking about empathy. The opposite is a great quote coming from Joe Ehrman. He used to be a pro football player with the Baltimore Colts in the 1970s, and he's also a former coach of kids in the Baltimore area. He's featured in the book Season of Life. Joe Ehrman says, indifference, the lack of being other-centered, not enough people taking on any kind of cause beyond themselves. That's the opposite of what Atticus is saying with respect to empathy. So I wanted to ask Natalie, what is your best or favorite definition of empathy?
So for me, what's really interesting, when Tony and I first started down this path to write this book, Tony asked me, okay, Nat, you've been in this field for a long time. What the heck happened here? Why aren't companies customer centric? To him, it's kind of like it's in his DNA. It's in my DNA, right? It doesn't make sense to not do that. And I have an early story of one of my first jobs as an engineer and how the company decided to do something I thought was antithetical to being customer centric. And it like shocked me. It like went like reverberated in my whole body. And I'm like, what, wait a minute. Like they were leaving the room and I'm like, wait, I got to understand. I just went to school to do the right thing here. And you want to do something that it just doesn't resonate with me. I need to understand this. So my definition and the definition that Tony and I used in the book is the ability to sit in the seat of someone else, see the world through their eyes, and then take action from their point of view. So let me give you a little tiny silly story. My friend calls me at 2:30 in the morning and he went to a concert and he got pushed down and his forehead got, broke open. And so he calls me and he goes, I'm bleeding. I'm like, oh my God, like, should I call an ambulance? He goes, no, I just need you. I just need some super glue. I go, what? Okay, this is a tough dude, right? He's like Mr. Hunter, Mr. Survivor. He goes, I just need some super glue. My super glue little, you know, like the little containers dry up. Does you have any super glue? And I got like, so I'm rummaging around in the drawer and I'm like, no, I don't, but I could go to CVS. I said, let me come down and look at the cut. So I look at it and I'm like, oh, liquid bandage. And he looks at me and he goes, no, super glue. Right. So I go to the CVS and I get super glue and I get liquid bandage and I come back and he goes, okay, what'd you get me? And I made this little gift basket, like with super glue and with the liquid bandage and some other stuff. And so a couple days later, he stops by to thank me. And he said, thank you for hearing me and seeing me. I'm like, what? And he goes, you were right. Liquid bandage was the right thing to do. He said, but in the moment, you saw me and heard me, and I asked for super glue, and that's what you delivered. And so for me, that's, we all think, like when we listen, we think we know what somebody else needs and wants. And a lot of times maybe you were right. But for me, empathy means sitting in the seat of that other person and really listening and understanding and acting from that place. And then just learning, did I do it? Didn't I do it? How could I do it better? So.
And in your story, it's completely the opposite. Not the opposite. It's not sympathy. So there's a difference between empathy and sympathy, right?
Right. So a lot of people, well, you know, like they look at the cover and they go, oh, this is going to be like how to build a kumbaya factory. And I'm a nuts and bolts girl. I have a PhD in engineering. So be rest assured, if you read the book, you're going to get some concrete stuff, a lot of concrete stuff. Because what I learned was, even though people and humans and emotion are really key to business, and we see like all the science, the neuroscience and heart math and all the things that are in there that do make up how we feel does affect how we do business. What I saw I really needed for, you know, a business audience was facts, just the facts. And so it is sprinkled with a ton of facts from all my mentors and all the people that I respect in this field. And it's really important to be clear and concrete.
Now I'm saying this with a smile on my face, but 20 years ago, when I was less wise, less intelligent, I would have said there's a stereotype toward people who are very customer-centric. My stereotype would be, oh, those are the more affectionate people. They're more people-centric. And as I looked at your background, and you kind of set this up for my next question, you're a brainiac. I mean, you are. And you mentioned you're an engineer, and you've had some very impressive positions in your career. So I'm curious about your origin story. How did it go from this academic, highly academic, you said PhD, did I catch that? That's right. Yeah. To writing about customer and employee empathy. How did you get from that point to this point?
So I think that what I found was in business, you really have two assets. You have employees and customers, right? So as I think because I'm a right-left brain person, so I could always see, I could see what the CFO wanted. I could see what the CIO, the CTO, the CEO, and I could also see what the human talent organization wanted. And I think because I am relatable, I'm not, I'm, you know, I wear my heart on my sleeve. And that's partially from being from the South, I think, or part of, I was born in Montana, but I spend a lot of time in Kentucky. In Louisville.
Beautiful part of the country, by the way.
Yeah, I used to say, y'all come back now, you're here, back in the day when I was growing up. And I think what happened to me was I could see the necessity. I could see the necessity for, you know, the factual part. But I also think that I saw this human side of business. And to me, I think maybe that's how my brain is wired, is that you need to have them come together and they need to find a way to coexist. And when you get them to coexist together, that's the best of both worlds.
I want to make something very clear on the book. It's not just for chief executive officers and the C-suite or the senior leadership team. I mean, as we start, especially in a bigger organization, when you start working your way down at the lower levels, this book is for everyone because everyone has a customer. It may not be the customer who writes the check or pays the credit card, but everyone has a customer. And of course, everyone is working with other people. So my strong opinion, this book is just not for the leadership teams. It's for everybody. Push back if you want to, but that's my strong opinion as I've gone through this book.
I think you're right. I think it is for everybody because businesses, as we, you know, we started talking about the two assets. And what I think is fascinating is when you are looking at your assets in a business, so to look at kind of the factual part of things, what I found fascinating and why I think people need to be integrated into the conversation and to be accounted for is, let's say you didn't have employees. Well, now you don't have anybody to create products and services. You could have buildings, you could have machines, you could have all this stuff, but nothing is going to happen without them. Even with AI and robotics, still somebody has to set up the robots and get them to do what you want them to do. And then you have another entity called customers. And customers are the ones who buy those products and services. So you have two really key assets, yet neither one is on the P&L. And we don't really account for their value. But without either of them, we can't have a business. And so whether those two assets remain in your favor, so generating really great products and services, being, like especially in a downturn, are they being really innovative and really figuring out new ways to approach customers and new products and just really turning things around so that we can get through this really difficult time? And customers, right? Are you appealing to your customers? If you don't have people buying your stuff and buying your stuff and buying more stuff over a longer period of time, which just relates to customer lifetime value, then you're not going to be in business. And so what's fascinating to me is you have these two assets. We don't account for them. We don't account for how they're treated or the experience that they have, and whether they trust you and whether they are loyal is dependent on their experience. And so the key here is my origin story really comes from getting taught hard nuts and bolts facts. I went to the University of Michigan, undergrad, master's, PhD from UCLA in material science. I took high energy particles. I slammed them into titanium aluminides. I changed the molecular structure. It went from a very high temperature, brittle material to more ductile so that like tiles on the spaceship, the space shuttle wouldn't fall off. So, right, really, really hardcore stuff, because if your shuttle tiles crack off, that's a big problem on reentry. And yet, we don't have the people doing the things, then you don't really have anything, right, to base your business on. And so, my origin story is really looking at how important the people are to making the things that you want to have happen.
Right now, there is a big disconnect between what business leaders think is happening and what actually is happening. Here's a quote right from the beginning of the book. 71% of companies cite overall customer experience as their top strategic performance measure. Pause. Only 13% of those same organizations self-rate their customer experience delivery as scoring a 9 out of 10 or better. You also had some other similar numbers before what I just cited. What is going on? What's the why here? And you're smiling. I can't wait to hear. I can't wait to hear the answer.
So there's many whys,
and you can be sarcastic if you want.
Well, because they don't get it, right? But I don't really want to make anybody wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's part of what, Tony, the exploration in the book was really about that. So I went back to the first industrial revolution. And in that industrial revolution, and there's a great documentary by the History Channel folks called The Titans Who Built America. And it's really fantastic. And what it showed is that America and Europe and other countries were going from an agrarian society into this like industrial. So it was Ford and Boeing and JP Morgan and Carnegie Mellon. And from their, souls, they birthed these amazing inventions and amazing, companies and products and services. But they did it with a mindset of profit over people. And they did it with business effectiveness and efficiency. Mm-hmm. Which was far more important, right? And they were actually, what's really interesting in the first three-part series is they were killing each other. They were trying to take away business from each other. I'm going to take your oil, and I'm going to take your railroad, and I'm going to put you out of business. And what's fascinating in the third part of the series is when we start to enter into World War III or World War II. It's when we start to enter World War II. FDR says, hey, guys, I need you to collaborate because we have a common enemy. And if you don't collaborate, we are going to lose something very special to us, which is freedom. And so here you have people having this very me centric, all about me, my, you know, pile of cash and greed and however you want to interpret the amass of a lot of money and not treating your employees or your customers very well. And then all of a sudden they become country centric and freedom centric, and their values and their behaviors and the things that they do and how they transform their plants and how they collaborate and how really it's these business titans that saved the country. And so it's just like, it's a double goosebump moment for me every time I talk about it and I watch the show. And so I think that we go back to the title, right? Empathy. When you sit in the seat of the other, whether it's the customer, the employee, the planet, freedom, and you see the world through that other person's perspective, and what's needed and wanted changes so dramatically that then you have to start to look at, okay, so what's the technology that we're using? How are we accounting for the things that we value? Is that driving behaviors on Wall Street and with investors in ways that aren't necessarily going to deliver the outcome that we've now come to realize that are really important? And then what are our leadership principles? Do we have a lot of, you know, not invented here and psychologically unsafe workplaces where people get yelled at and you can't be honest or open. You end up with groupthink, then you end up like General Magic, which with a really amazing construct for a product, but it didn't go anywhere. And they had like some of the best partnerships, and you know, Sony is a product company. I mean, they had the world by the tail, and yet they couldn't pull it together. So what Tony and I found was it's a combination of your financial metrics and your perspective, your leadership, your culture. And then truthfully, part of why we talk about the first industrial revolution and the technology is that up until now, we've really, and truthfully, because I'm an analyst and I'll be truthful here, we have never been able to deliver experiences in the way that we can now because of the transformation of exponential technologies.
I have a confession to make. Before I read your book, I did some reading on you on a website, I think your website, and I thought, this is really good stuff. And I kept doing more reading about you. It's like, this is going to be a great book. But before I opened it up, I had this thought that I'd already had read Joe Pyne's book twice, which in the green room, you'd mentioned you're a big fan of his book, The Experience Economy. So I came into your book already. I believe in this. I'm going to agree with every word you write, even before I open up the cover. Of course, I start reading and it's like, I agree. So a lot of this is common sense to me. So I got to figure out what's the best way to ask a very believable question. My question, and you can help rephrase the question if you want, but why is this so powerful? Why is being customer-centric and employee-centric so powerfully effective? See, I know the answer because I'm going to believe in your answer, but I feel like I'm not asking it with the greatest of emotion because I believe in this is common sense. But for the people who are on the fence or are indifferent, why is this critical?
Well, it's critical. So if you look at the airline industry right now, so I was just, I had a couple of business trips and the planes are late. There's not enough planes. Flights get canceled. You got to double check right before you go to the airport. And even when you're at the airport, right? So, you know, I started talking because I'm always doing research, right? So I was talking to the grounds people and the pilots and they said, we don't have enough people, right? They laid off a lot of people during COVID to be able to run their businesses. They didn't rehire. It takes a long time to train commercial pilots. So now that now the world's returning to some sort of, I guess, semblance of where we were before, not quite as fast, but still pretty fast, they don't have people. So if you can't fly, or you can't fly enough, how do you stay in business? Right. And so I've gone to lots of restaurants where I'll go, you know, and wait to be seated. And I can say, you know, there's lots of empty tables here. Right. How come you don't want to seat us? And they're like, well, we don't have enough cooks and we don't have enough waiters. So again, you're looking at this people part of business. That means that, you know, normally I serve 100 meals in an evening or 1,000 meals, depending on how big your establishment is. Or I do, I don't know, 20,000 flights. And now I can do half that. So that's where I think that people miss the point here, is that this combination of people and business is really key. And we've hit the great resignation, right? So COVID did a lot of things, and I don't want to make slight of or, you know, I want to acknowledge all the hardship that people went through during COVID. And I think there are always some good things that come out of these things. And one is that it created a cause for pause. And we all asked ourselves, we slowed down, and we said, is this what we want for our lives, for our work life, for our home life, for family? And in that moment of self-reflection, right, which lasted for a good 2 years, and I think it's still going on, you see people choosing differently. You see employees, you know, talking about, I just saw an article about the number of teachers who are not going back in September, right? Our youth is our future. Somebody needs to teach them, but it has been so difficult for so long for teachers. And then you add this COVID situation on top of it, and they didn't fix things. And so teachers are just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, it's breaking my heart to not go back and see my students, but I have to take care of me. And so I think no matter what business you're in, you know, you want some notes for how to get through this recession. I think you really got to start with your employees, and you really got to start with your customers, and just ask yourself, am I really taking care of those two assets and the experiences that they're having? And if not, you can expect to not make it through this, perhaps.
Early in the book, you bring up, and you've already mentioned this in passing about the two assets, but the lack of customer-centric information in financial statements. I mean, you're not going to find that on the P&L. I suppose you could say if our sales are dropping, that could have an impact. On the other hand, if your sales are going up, we don't know what sales are at risk because we're not serving our customers in the best of ways. But I do want to rant. Do I have permission to rant?
Please. I feel like I'm doing all the talking. I'd love, honestly, if I'm being an empathy practitioner, I'd love to hear your point of view.
One of my rants on this topic of customer results, customer centricity, not showing up on the P&L, the balance sheet, cash flows. You and I know that NPS is starting to be more widely reported with some of the Fortune 500 firms. I even have a problem with NPS because sometimes I don't think they're asking the right question. Sometimes the right question isn't, would you recommend us? Sometimes I think the question is, will you buy from me next time and why? Sometimes I just feel like even something as simple as NPS, I think it's a great learning tool, but I don't think it can always answer the right question or the best question. So that's my mild rant when it comes to customer data that's being reported in the financials, around the financials. Did I mess that up?
No, I can't agree with you more. I think, you know, and again, point in time, right? So there's nothing wrong with the things that happen in that moment because somebody had an idea and it was important and it brought forth new thoughts and new ways of doing business. So not to say that those guys are wrong, right? But now we look in context and having measured NPS for a number of years, to me, the question would be not, would you recommend us? Because I think they were looking at word of mouth and the power of word of mouth. Right, so right. Got it. I think that is important. But did you buy from us? And how much did your spending increase? and did it increase over time? So we're getting back to things like customer lifetime value, or as an employee, they always do employee surveys, you know, and I think the questions that they ask employees about how happy they are with the workplace also aren't from the customer or the employee's point of view, and they don't necessarily measure whether I'm going to be really productive, innovative, bring my best self to work, share my best ideas, or do I feel like there was a funny video that my 21-year-old nephew sent me, and it was called The Imitator, which is like somebody who, like, you say something and then somebody else in the meeting says it and everybody goes, yeah, what John said. And you're like, but I just said that, right? Or someone says, you know, I had this really amazing thought. What if we did it this way? And they're like, yeah, you know, that's great, Nat, but we don't really do it here that way, right? Not invented here kind of stuff. And so you don't have that open and honest kind of communication. And then people go, you know what, I'll just show up, collect a paycheck. And so there's degrees to which there's commitment, right? And emotional commitment to what you're doing. And I think oftentimes we miss the importance of how things are getting done, right? And I don't know that I just think that we think someone comes to work and they're really putting in 8 hours. What's the quality of the 8 hours, right? And when someone buys from us, you know, I think businesses have to really be concerned about what is that customer lifetime value. And I think NPS, you know, I'm with you. I would rather measure something that is more concrete, like, look at, did you buy from us? And I think, you know, I'm an Amazon Prime person, right? And so I order a lot from them.
Yes.
And I've ordered my spending with that, like, I'm looking at my bank statement and going, wow, and it's increased over time. And why? Because it's easy, because it's simple, because the returns are simple.
That's because huge.
The products are always good, right? It's what I need and want as a customer. So when they're sitting in the seat of the customer, and one of the reasons, because people don't know this, one of the reasons Amazon became so successful was in the very beginning days, Jeff used to conduct meetings and he would have the set of evangelist customers, and he would go back to them and he would ask them every single day, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? What do you think about that?
Right.
Give us feedback. Try this, right? And he was always trying to make the experience better from that customer point of view. And so because they honed that over so many years, they've got this spot on. And so that's like a really good kind of case study of what happens. I mean, a lot of people don't know that they did that. And when you do that and you really serve your customers, I mean, why wouldn't you buy from somebody who provides you what you want and need and even delights you? And why wouldn't you want to be that company and that brand?
I was going to say, we've had John Rossman on the show. He wrote the book, The Amazon Way. He's one of the executives that worked there a number of years ago. And he talks about where the leadership team will get together and they'll keep one seat empty, and that seat represents the customer, which we've heard that story a lot. One of the hard things about this book is, okay, what big ideas am I going to bring up? And I did not write all these down, but when I'm reading a book, I'll have a separate notepad of just things I either want to go back to or just take note of. I'm just going to write down this list real quickly, and then we'll pick two or three. You do mention Clayton Christensen, the jobs to be done construct. And of course, that got me. It's like, okay, she's sharp. Just to introduce that, you got the empathy in action flywheel. That may be one part of your intellectual property. Business blind spots is huge. And then part of the tool that you use throughout the book is you mentioned these blind spots throughout. I loved it. You brought up the OODA loop, and we've had on John Boyd, who innovated the OODA loop. We've had on his biographer, and I thought, this is great. And of course, personalization, Lee Scott's leadership list. That was great. You've got the four eras, which is outstanding, by the way. The four empathy pillars. I wish we could spend a whole hour just on the four empathy pillars, and you've got that trademark. There's an image on page 214, which is brilliant. So again, it's like, what am I going to ask? So let's just bring up jobs to be done. And again, you're smiling. It's like, she's thinking, I wonder if he's going to ask me the right ones. It'd be interesting which ones should she have thought I should bring up, but let's hit jobs to be done. Why did you pick on Clayton DeLake, Clayton Christensen? Oh, what a great mind, great human being. That's introduced in the book because...
So I got to take a class from Clayton before he passed away, and I was so, like, such an honor, right? And I was so impressed with his ability to take something that seems so simple, which is how do you deliver something that your customers want and couch it in this idea of the job to be done, right? Because that's kind of how I think. So you have CEOs who have this like art of the possible and here's where we're going and high flying picture. And then you have the next level management that's trying to make those guys really happy. Right. And then you have all the people that are trying to get something done, the job to be done. And that's mostly where managers live. And so they need employees to get the job to be done. And so if you explain the job to be done as something that will garner the loyalty, the trust and the loyalty of your customer, that changes what you might have thought the job to be done. And so going back to one of my stories of origin, working at a car company, and they asked me about two-sided galvanizing, which is the protective coating before a car gets painted. And they said, you know, it costs us a lot of money to do that. Would it be possible to just do one? And they're coming to me as a corrosion engineer, right? I'm a material scientist, metallurgist. But I said, yeah, I can run the corrosion test. Like I said, I can pretty much tell you right now, if you want to save the time and the money, but I'll do the experiments, but you need two-sided galvanizing. We did that for a reason. But anyways, so I did it. They go, okay, well, thanks, Nat. And I go, wait, I want to know what are you guys going to do? And they're going to go, well, we did the numbers and we get what you're saying, but we're going to do one-sided galvanizing. And I'm like, but wait a minute. And this is where jobs to be done really clicked with me, right? In the moment, I didn't know about it. But when I went back and I started to self-reflect, I thought the job to be done was to make amazing cars that didn't rust so that you'd have cars driving around, especially, you know, living in Detroit at the time, there's snow and ice and lots of rust on cars. They thought the job to be done was to make the car less expensive. So depending on whether you use a business-centric point of view or you use a customer-centric point of view, the job to be done changes.
As I was preparing for this, what is the best topic to bring up in terms of applicability, practicality? Tell me if I got this right. Empathy in action. It's so simple. Listen, understand, predict, act, then learn. I think this may be the most practical. Well, jobs to be done is so applicable to customer centricity. But in terms of applying it, I mean, I'm even thinking the person at the call center can use the listen and understand, act, learn. The technician at a Ford dealership or a GM dealership, they can apply that. So this tool of listen, understand, act, learn it's brilliant. What can you add to that? What have I missed anything?
So what was interesting was you have all these concepts, right? And then you need to be able to communicate to people because they're going to say, okay, got it, right? Got it. We need to do something different. What is it that you want me to do, right? And so part of empathy, right, was how do they empathize? So let's say you and I were in a conversation. The first thing I'd do, Mark, is I'd listen and I'd start to understand who you are and what's important to you. And then I'd go, you know what? I think this would be a really fun story to tell Mark. And so then in the conversation, I'd tell the story. And as we got to know each other and build a really great relationship, I'd tell more stories and you'd be doing the same thing. And as human beings, we do this naturally. And so part of what we wanted to do was to say what we do naturally can be codified, can be codified in a process that anybody can use, whether you're a waitress or whether you're a pilot or whether you're a CEO in a company or a CFO. And what we also found really fascinating was that you could design software that can actually do this. And that's where you get the scalability.
Jim Collins would be very impressed, I think, with your five levels of empathy. Mm-hmm. So he's got his five levels of leadership. You got your five levels of organizational commitment. And level one, I would almost call toxicity. It's like, don't even want to go.
No, it
there.
Is toxicity. Okay. I was being polite.
You were being polite.
It is. And I've been in those cultures, right? And left them. And I've been in cultures as a management consultant with some of the big six and the big four. I've been in, you know, like they're paying us a gazillion dollars to go in and try to help them do something. And for there's so much inertia and so much politics. It's like, well, we'll just sit back and collect the money because we know nothing's going to happen. And you can't say that to anybody, but it's so fascinating having been a management consultant and to be able to sit back and go, okay, they're at level two, they're at level one. It really doesn't matter what we say or what we do. They're so in their own way. And it's very, very frustrating.
I was going to say back to level one, you use the word inertia. That is a great word. I could not have picked. I mean, again, I do like toxicity, but inertia is really good. Level five, I mean, it's forward thinking, all in. And the only thing I just had to add to this is I would think that a company, let's say a company hires you to come help them with customer empathy, getting it, you know, let's transform this. I would think just starting here, figuring out where are we on this continuum? Are we on the left side where left side represents level one, which is again, politics, inertia, level five, all in, and actually nailing it as well. And even the employees, dedicated, loyal, stand up for one another. So is that a good starting point? Just looking at where are we? And even asking the employees for their input, where do you think we are?
Yeah, I think what I learned when I started as a consultant was to go. So we would do interviews, and we'd do interviews at the CEO level. We'd do interviews at you know, a couple layers down. And then we'd always want to go and talk to people who were actually customer facing or people who were in the IT department, kind of behind the scenes back office. And what I always found really fascinating was that depending on the stratosphere and where you sit, those answers really changed. And at the end of the day, if you don't have alignment among the stratospheres, then you might have somebody saying at the top, great, you know, all these like, you know, platitudes, but then the people at the bottom are rolling their eyes going, yeah, here they go again, saying the stuff that we know is not true, but it's plastered on the wall. And I remember one of my early jobs where they were asking about, you know, how do employees feel about the workplace? And we said we weren't happy and why, and they redecorated the elevators and we all got a coffee cup. Now what happened in that industry was a lot of those, it was a high tech industry and a lot of the digital signal processing, engineers and programmers left and went to San Francisco. And that really hurt the industries here in Los Angeles. But, you know, it was preventable. A lot of these things that happen to business, it's preventable if they're sitting in the seat of their employees and their customers and seeing the world through their eyes and taking care of, I mean, you know, you nailed it. The big killer is indifference, because indifference leads to cognitive dissonance. And when the cognitive dissonance gets so big, and I think that's part of what the Great Resignation is about. So for those who don't know what that means, for me, it means the difference between what I'm experiencing in my reality and what I'd like it to be or what it needs to be for me to feel safe and okay and motivated. And when that gets really big, then that's when you see people go, you know what? I'm going to get a 3% raise and inflation is this and I have competitors offering me more money and it may not be better, but at least I'm progressing somehow. you know, financially, or, you know, people are just really questioning what do they want from their life. And so you can't have a employee body like a zeitgeist where everybody's just, you know, that stratosphere is not in alignment, and you can't have, you know, employees feeling indifferent about their work, because that leads to, that actually costs you money. And so one of my challenges, Mark, is I would love a CFO to come to me and say, Nat, this is so intriguing. I'm going to help you create metrics and a process to measure this stuff that you're talking about. Because here's what I learned, because I wrote one of the first ROI models for social media back when people said, oh, it's just people taking their cats for a walk or updating that they ate a sandwich. And I'm like, no. Look at the, so one of my ROIs was, look at the market research that you could get about your brand, about the comments. And a really short story, because I know we have more to cover. It was a diaper bag company. And they were trying, they were like, oh, I really want to be innovative. So they brought me in to be, you know, like help them think different, right? And I said, well, how about we just look at your social media and what people are posting? And they're like, well, social media doesn't matter, right? And I'm like, well, okay, so let's take a look. So Bob here says that you have a fantastic diaper bag. However, he feels like it's too flowery and is a little embarrassed to take it to the game. Loves his kids, definitely all in on changing the diapers and being a present dad. But is there any way that you could just make it be a little bit more like blue jeans or leather looking? I said, there's your market research. And you see all these likes, all these, you know, people are going, yeah, like that. Long story short, they create a new product and this new style, bestseller. Find a whole new marketplace, a whole new market segment, high return on investment because nobody else is doing it. So again, this concept, Mark, is so, it's like E equals MC squared. And I don't want to take anything away from Einstein, because what he did was like really freaking amazing. But the concept for business people is sit in the seat of your customers and employees, see the world through their eyes, and you will find out so much information. It will change your life. It will change how you think, and it will change how you do business.
We are so much on the same page. I will send you a link, and I'll mention this in our outro. His name is Mike Berlin. He was on our show a couple of years ago. Mike's firm has proprietary software that can measure the velocity of the vibe in your brand. So for example, let's say you've got, I'm making this up. Let's say you are an expert in CRM systems. And let's say you're part of a certain brand. I won't say any names, but let's say the vibe in, say on Twitter, Facebook, even Instagram, they have a way of tracking all of those communications, which are unsolicited. And they come up with a number.
So they're real.
It's real.
How people really feel. It's not 12 people you're feeding sandwiches to, and you got one person who leads, and then you got groupthink, right? That's like, and nothing wrong with market research, right? It is what we had. We had to do something, right? But now we created social platforms, and you can say whether they're good or bad, or right. But there are uses in business if you use a social listening platform, mm-hmm. and you start to be able to take that information in. And then, yeah, I'd love to talk to Mike about how he's measuring that, because I think that's, and what if you could turn that, oh, what about this, Mark? What if we could turn that inside the company and we could measure the vibe of the employees?
Hey, I've taken a lot of your time. Do we have time for just a really quick lightning round? And we,
sure.
We talked about this.
I'm all yours. This is fun.
Well, I want to be respectful of your schedule. Please tell your boss, thank you too. Let's say you're at a pick the grocery store that you go to. I don't mind calling out a name. My wife and I shop at Hy-Vee. I was telling you earlier in the green room, I've been going to Aldi for the first time ever. And we don't have a Trader Joe in Columbia. I'd go there if we did, which, by the way, we've interviewed one of Joe Klum's closest friends, and she wrote a book about him called Becoming Trader Joe. So pick your favorite grocery store wherever you shop out on the West Coast. When you're in there, are you thinking, are you thinking the way you write? It's like, I don't think they're very empathetic toward customers. What's your thoughts as you're going through your local grocery store?
Well, it's interesting because I can't help myself but evaluate everything, right? Sometimes, you know, I get reminded, just be present, right? Especially if I'm at a Hollywood Bowl event or just, you know, things go wrong and nothing is perfect, right? So we live in an imperfect world and we have to allow for those. But I think for a brand, what you're looking for is consistency over longer periods of time. And sure, there's anomalies and you want to apologize when there's an anomaly. But I think, you know, whether I'm shopping or whether, well, I recently bought a car and I did go to dealers and it was yucky.
Oh my gosh. And it didn't
really
have to be.
Really yucky.
It didn't have to be.
Right. And I was like, okay, I tried it. I thought I hadn't bought in a car at a dealer in a while. I thought, let me go back. Let me see. It was yucky, yucky, yucky. So I went to Carvana. I went online. I looked at CarMax, Carvana, a couple of those online experiences. And I found the car I wanted. I did the little heart, kind of like, you know, when you're dating, you find the car that you like. And then I made a spreadsheet and I was like, okay, that one. And the experience with Carvana was so fantastic. And I'm not getting paid for this advertisement or endorsement. It was so fantastic. The whole process was clear. It was easy. I got the car of my dreams. There was no weird sales trickery. I didn't get upselled or cross-selled. It was very transparent what I was paying for and how I was paying for it. So yeah, everywhere I go, every business, like, look out. Natalie's coming to town and she's going to evaluate the experience. And, you know, I don't always say something, but it crosses my mind. And I'm, you know, sometimes when I talk to businesses and sometimes when they're really open, I share it. But a lot of times people are not expecting it.
I'm trying to pick really mundane businesses. I've been a customer of the UPS store for about 16 years. Now, before someone says, but they weren't around 16 years ago, well, that was, I had a mailboxes, et cetera. And then, so my time with them goes back then. So what would be your advice? And those are locally owned, in case you don't have I was getting ready to call it a subscription. I guess you could say it is a subscription because I pay every quarter. What would be your advice to an owner of a UPS store? How can we be more customer centric? Again, it's a pretty basic business model.
So I would say shop your competitors, be a mystery shopper. So go check out, you know, the United States Post Office, go check out the experience with FedEx or HDL or wherever the other competitors. And I think what happens is a lot of people in business forget that it's like they have amnesia when they're thinking about business. They get so business centric and here's what we're doing and this is how we're going to do it. And then they forget their customers. So go be a customer.
Right. Good point.
Go be a customer of your own store. Go be a customer of your competitors. And then ask yourself, which one would I buy from? And then if it's not you, then what could you change to make it you? Because if you're thinking it, probably every single person who's passed through those doors is thinking the same thing.
I have a feeling if someone hires you to be a consultant, you require a big check. So I'm going to ask you a question where someone would be paying you a big check. So in Columbia, Missouri, in nearby Fulton, which, by the way, Churchill once spoke there many years ago, we have a Dollar General distribution center. I know a little bit about that DC. I know that sometimes the supervisors can be not so nice to the staff below them. They can be the opposite of empathetic. The general managers hired you to talk about how supervisors need to be more empathetic toward the staff. Many don't have high school educations. Some do. They come from all backgrounds. How do you get them to at least start thinking about being more employee-centric?
I actually love my dollar store. Whenever I have, it's fun to go there, right? Because it's seasonal things. It's the 4th of July. It's Labor Day. It's a birthday, right? And they have the cutest things. Like I bought these really cute heart plates for my friend who's very sentimental for her birthday. Great stuff for the 4th of July. I mean, nice little containers. So for me, I love the stuff that's in the dollar store, right? So if I love the product and I love the price, but what I don't like about it is the experience, then is it possible that maybe I would choose to pay a little bit extra to order it online? Or maybe I'd go somewhere else and pay two or three or five times what I would have paid there, maybe like a container store or, I don't know, a party store. And so you have to start to think about the people that go there and love your store and want most. Most customers want to love the interaction with you. They want to love the store. They want to love the experience of being in that store and the treasures that you find there, right? And so if you could think of training your employees as people finding those treasures, finding those bargains, everybody loves a good bargain, right? And so start to think about the customers who are coming in there are really on a treasure hunt to find something really cool for whatever event or thing that they need or extra supplies, and then think about the idea of becoming the place where people think of going first. And so dollar stores operate on a very low margin. They probably don't pay people really well. But does that mean that people who work there need to be grumpy and managers need to be grumpy and they need to treat their staff poorly? Because if you think about it, if the top level people treat the next level people bad and the next level people treat the next level. So by the time that you get to that customer facing employee, the customer is going, wow, great deal, but we're not coming back here. This is creepy. So all the things that you just did, which was gathering all this stuff from all these places to sell really inexpensively with a very tight margin, you just pushed your customer out the door to somebody else. Why would you do that, Mark? Why would you do that? Help me understand, like, you may not buy into the premise of what I'm saying in the book, but why would you do things antithetical to push customers and employees away from your business?
I would say it's a leadership that doesn't care, which is my next question. How do we deal?
But do you think they don't care? Or do you think that they've just been in this profit over people mindset so long? And one of the interesting things, and this is really an honor to me, is that there's a couple books that have recently come out, and we have been actually mentioned in the company of some of these books. And what's really fascinating is that I think there is a zeitgeist of change here. And part of that change is to look at books like David Giles' new book, right? And so he's talking about The Man Who Broke Capitalism. And I worked at GE. I was a fan of Jack, but now people are saying that maybe, right? And then Roger Martin, who wrote A New Way to Think, and he talks a lot about Milton Friedman. And Milton Friedman said, you know, our perspective is that, you know, it's all about the stakeholder and value to the stakeholder and forget about your employees and customers because they're expendable. And then Alan Murray, who I got to meet at a Fortune magazine event, who wrote Tomorrow's Capitalist. And I think his book is My Search for the Soul of Business. And again, these really important people are talking about the same kinds of things, that the way we've always done things cannot be the way that we go forward.
I'm curious. We ask every guest this question. And I've seen you on one interview on YouTube. And I'm looking, I'm doing this, I'm trying to blow up the screen. I'm trying to see
the books on my bookshelf.
I'm trying to look at some of your books. And it's like, so you're a reader. What are some of your favorites?
Okay, so what's on my bookshelf? Clue Train Manifesto, Clayton Christensen's Innovator's Dilemma, Crossing the Chasm, Joe Pine, Experience Economy, The Ultimate Question. That's Bain's
book.
That
is great.
Bold. Bold is fantastic. Peter's an amazing author. I think he was one of the people that taught me all about exponential technologies and exponential thinking. So, yeah, I mean, if I could read for a living, that would be a really fun job.
And I'm curious, for someone specifically like you, where a lot of your reading is going to be highly academic, do you ever read anything that's non-business? Are there any books that you read? What are some of your favorite books that have inspired you outside of business books?
I would say authors like Hemingway are like really looking at the zeitgeist of the time and talking about, you know, the plight of people. So Hemingway is one of my favorite authors, because I think just the way that he was able to articulate what was happening, To Kill a Mockingbird, Pride and Prejudice, something more recent, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, and then The Little Prince, of course, the Harry Potter series. I mean, I think I spend a lot of time looking at story structure, because story, what I really think that we're talking about here, Mark, when we go through these points in time and we're now in the fifth industrial revolution, and I think what we're talking about and the people that will be successful leaders going forward, they're going through a hero's journey,
mm-hmm.
right? And so if you go back to Joseph Campbell's work,
right.
and you look at that hero who has, you know, some conflict or some challenge, and they have to go through the gauntlet, and then they wake up, right? And their whole world is now changed, and they have some mentors and they have some guides. But I feel like, you know, someone said to me, Nat, if you could leave a legacy, what would that be? And it would be that spark in that hero's journey to be the one of, I would like to be one of the people who was noted to start talking about these things at the beginning of the fifth industrial revolution, who said people matter and they matter on the bottom line. And we can measure it, and we can measure a business success, and we can predict it.
Your message is so simple, and you're easy to listen to. I don't feel like I'm being talked down to. So I love it when I talk to someone. Again, I'm not trying to embarrass you. You are a brainiac, but yet you speak in a language. It's like, I get this. I completely get this. So if that is a compliment, I hope I said that. I was articulate with that, but I cannot thank you enough for joining us here on the show.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think kind of the way my brain works is kind of like that, you know, really intellectual problem solving, crunching. And then maybe my superpower is to be very Dr. Seuss-like. So one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish. Listen, understand, act, and learn. Repeat. Do a Oda loop like a gazillion times. Like, don't ever stop.
I was going to say, all of these mental models in the book are so easy. And by the way, you asked me to say this because I forgot to mention it. This book is beautiful. The illustrations, the frameworks are outstanding. Bain, Accenture, McKinsey, they have nothing on you in this territory. So I'm just saying, very, very well done, Natalie. You've nailed it.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the honor of being on your show.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
Dr. Natalie Petahoff, thank you very much. The book is Empathy in Action. Let's say you are now the consultant. There is a large distribution center about 20 miles from my home. They are at DC, serving several hundred locations of a retail brand that you probably know very well. The starting pay, it's decent, but only because they don't have a choice. I know firsthand that hourly employees picking product are not treated well by their supervisors. Supervisors can be uncaring and only focused on hitting their numbers. Coaching and mentoring is non-existent with the hourly workers. A focus on camaraderie, it's not instilled. So you've heard the discussion about customer empathy and about employee empathy. So here is my question, consultant. What's the solution? How do you teach and show empathy to these frontline supervisors? Or let me reword that. How do you teach them to where they can start expressing empathy to the staff? That's your homework assignment. We need to call this a wrap. I'm Mark Gandy, and this is CFO Bookshelf.